Welcome to Roundtable Talk, a podcast about longevity, senior services marketing, and the quality of life as one ages. Roundtable Talk is brought to you by Pavone Group and Varsity, a senior services agency focused on helping clients win the mature market. If you like the fresh perspectives we deliver in each episode, please give Roundtable Talk a 5-star review on the podcast service of your choice. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Varsity's Roundtable Talk. My guest today is Dr. Linda Fried, a globally recognized public health leader, pioneer in healthy aging and frailty research, and the dean of Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. Her work has shaped how we think about aging, prevention, and the systems that support longer, healthier lives. Dr. Fried, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
And your research has helped shape the way we understand frailty as a key aspect of aging. For those who may not be familiar, how do you define frailty, and how does it differ from general aging or disability?
A very important question, and thank you for it, Derek. And by the way, please call me Linda. So I'm, as background, I'm a geriatrician, and I spent a good part of my career in clinical practice in geriatric medicine. And what I learned both as a clinician and as a scientist over many years, and worked with many scientists together in large teams to really define, is that there is a clinical, a medical condition which we call frailty, which generally starts with a decline in muscle mass and strength. And that's well recognized. In fact, Shakespeare codified it when he talked about a shrunk shank in an older man. That's what he was talking about. But over time, and this is an aging-related set of changes, what we see is a particular presentation that emerges with loss of muscle, loss of strength, loss of energy, slowing down physically, and in the later stages, unintentional weight loss as well. And any one of those is not frailty. Any two of those is not frailty. But when you start seeing a critical mass of them, then you're seeing somebody who has emerged with the condition of frailty. And what's going on that both causes those manifestations and is the real risk associated with frailty is that these are clinical presentations when there has been a significant change in our underlying biology and physiology, which is heavily aging related. And the process that's going on has to do with decreased effectiveness of key organ systems that really keep us balanced, maintain what scientists and clinicians would call homeostasis, the ability to bounce back from a stressor, whether that stressor is having the flu or having surgery or being in a too hot or too cold setting for too long. There are lots of stressors that our bodies, when we're younger, bounce back from and handle. But our body becomes less able to handle those stressors. And the kind of changes I just described mark the more extreme development of that. Why does it matter? Well, it's probably obvious if I say that you can't handle stressors as well, it means you don't bounce back as well from them. You don't recover as well from an illness. It takes longer. And in fact, people who are frail are at risk of not recovering unless the circumstances are right.
Interesting. So, Linda, what first led you to focus your research on frailty in older adults?
Well, it was my patients. I was really impressed that there was a subset of my patients who seemed to be at risk. You know, the thought when you think of somebody who's frail, and I've spoken to thousands of patients and thousands of older people and said, can you recognize, do you know anyone who's frail? And everybody always says yes. They raise their hands and they say yes. And if I ask them, which I have for 30 years, how do you know they're frail? And they'll say exactly the things I just said. Well, they sort of look like the wind could blow them over, or they're really weak or too thin or walking too slowly. And so I saw that in my patients. And it was very clear to me that this was a subset that had particular risks for not recovering well. I mean, that's what I saw clinically, for dying in the face of immense stressors or illness when others might not, for not being able to handle surgery as well. And so this is many years ago now, but I realized at the time that there were two things going on in geriatric medicine. One was that everybody was convinced that frailty was a critical condition that geriatricians had a responsibility to prevent or improve. But there was not agreement on what defined someone being frail. And in the absence of a clear definition at the time, this is now the mid-1980s, late 1980s, in the absence of a definition, then trials of different therapies were not consistently testing them on the same people.
Interesting.
And so I went ahead with probably a somewhat naive thought that I really needed to figure this out. You never know how long it's going to take or how complicated things can get. And I spent many years, initially by myself and then with more and more other scientists, working on trying to define it so that we could understand clearly
what
the presentation was and what changes in the body it signified, and then whether it was a problem or not. There are lots of things like whether one's hair turns gray, that doesn't change your risk for bad outcomes, except maybe socially. So we had to know that, in fact, being able to recognize this condition mattered to the health of the person, mattered in terms of the kinds of clinical care they might need, and mattered in terms of finding opportunities to slow down its development or to prevent it if that was possible. And so I've spent many decades working on that and can now say, because of my patients, that they taught me. And we do know that this is a medical syndrome, a clinical syndrome that requires diagnosis and warrants both prevention and treatment.
Sure. That's fascinating. Now, you'd mentioned a lot of your patients are older adults in that field. But how early in life should we be thinking about frailty prevention? What can people do?
So I think the most important thing to do is to make physical activity part of your life and find ways to enjoy it. That's very important. And to maintain muscle strength. You don't have to be a weightlifter. Taking walks matters, but strengthening exercises, lifting small weights.
How often should you do that?
Well, I think this, you know, it's important. I'm going to start just with kids. It's important to teach kids the habit of being physically active. And because once you learn that as a child or an adolescent, then it's with you for life. In the second half of life, we start losing muscle mass. And we lose it a little bit each decade. And after a while, it starts adding up and strength declines. And so it's really important to maintain your strength and to do resistance exercises with some weightlifting. Not a lot, doesn't have to be a lot, three times a week.
Okay.
for 20 minutes or so. And then to be able to do some aerobic exercise on top of that, to walk, join a walking club, and then carry that on through the rest of your life. That is the best prevention there is.
That's great advice. Now, you know, you talked about how halfway through your life you start to lose some of that. Can frailty be reversed, or is it primarily about managing decline?
So it appears that until it's very severe, it's potentially reversible. But of course, either preventing it in the first place or slowing down its development through exercise in particular, and staying active and engaged in things you love is important. That works, and you can nip it in the bud.
Sure, sure. Now you talked earlier about some of your work in, I believe it was the mid-late 80s, in defining frailty, but how can we better communicate to the public and policymakers that frailty is a key public health concern?
Well, that's probably something we have to figure out together. I think it's important also to communicate to clinicians, because I think geriatricians understand that, but I don't know how far this has gone beyond geriatricians, that this is an important medical diagnosis. And in clinical practice, tracking people's strength over time, their walking speed, just to measure usual walking speed for 15 feet in the hallway of a clinic, those two things alone, just tracking over time, are really informative. How do we persuade policymakers this matters? I think that's a critical question, because, of course, we want physicians to be alerting patients and being advising patients. And we also want patients to be able to get the therapy and clinical care that they need. And so that involves policymakers.
Sure, sure. Interesting. So thinking about senior living communities, what can they do to better accommodate residents with frailties? And, you know, senior living communities obviously have the independent living, assisted living, skilled nursing. So there is the continuum there generally. But what can they do?
Well, I think it's useful maybe every 6 months to measure the two things that I just described. Someone's grip strength in a standardized way, and then follow it over time, and their walking speed. And then to be able to recommend, prescribe a physical activity regimen for people to follow, three, ideally four times a week. Not enough to be every day, and it can vary from day to day, is really important. And on top of that, but not instead, making sure that people have access to and are eating adequate protein is really important.
That's great. Now, you mentioned grip strength and walking speed. Are those two of the primary metrics or measurements, I guess,
that you
would follow?
They are. So there are five criteria for frailty, and those are two of them, and they're two of the earliest ones.
Interesting. Good. Okay. So how can we build a society where older adults don't just live longer, but truly thrive?
Well, that is a critical question for all of us. In fact, in 2018, the U.S. National Academy of Medicine decided that this was the number one grand challenge in the world, was to answer that question. And I was honored to be asked by them to chair a global commission to develop a global roadmap for healthy longevity for all nations. And that was published in 2022. I can recommend it as a guidebook to answer your question. It's free on the web at the National Academy of Medicine.
We'll be sure to put a link to that on the website. We'll find out from you afterwards and make sure that we have the correct link. But thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. So we know a lot scientifically. And I'll start with what you just said, which is had a lot in the question. One is that we have learned, and certainly the National Academy of Medicine Global Roadmap recognizes, that it is possible to design a society in which people have opportunity to live long lives with health. We've created the long lives part, but we have not created the with health part for most people. And it is possible, based on the knowledge we have now, to get going on it.
That's great.
The second thing we have learned, because for many people, saying that is not persuasive enough, in large part because of our ageism, because we see in when we think about older people as a society, we see what I call the 60s, our own fears of death and dying, of decrepitude, of disease, of disability, of dementia and decline. And that's what comes into people's minds are and when we talk about older people. But in fact, what we've learned is, I think, two very important things as well, which to me changed the narrative and the expectations. The first thing we've learned is that it would be possible to design a society for longer lives. And as I said, we've created the longer lives. We've added 30 years to human life expectancy in the last 100 years. It's an amazing feat. But now it would be possible to design a society where people live longer lives and all of society can thrive because of longevity.
Hmm. Yeah.
So the other fear we have is that if we invest in older people, somehow we're taking food and resources out of the mouths of young people. And in fact, we've learned that it doesn't have to be that way, that this could be a win-win equation.
Yeah, what a shame to have that philosophy, but I do hear that.
Right. I think, well, it's common expectations, even if people don't say it.
Yeah.
But now, the evidence counters that from A to Z.
Sure, sure. Now, I'm curious. So you were chairing this committee on a global scale. What were some of the other countries that you were interacting with? Or I realize it covered the globe, but who are some of the others in your purview?
So our global commission was co-chaired by John Wong, who was the dean of the School of Medicine at the National University of Singapore. We had representatives from China, from Chile, from Costa Rica, from South Africa, from France and England, and basically almost every continent.
That's fantastic.
And of course, the U.S., a number of members from the U.S. And then Geneva. And then we did consultations around the world on each continent to get feedback on what we were seeing as the possibilities.
That's really terrific. That's great. And I know you said it was an honor, and I'm sure it was a really interesting experience too to really be able to guide that discussion.
Yeah, no, very exciting.
That's great. So I'm curious, what role do social connections and community play in the health and quality of life of older adults?
I would say almost everything. So something I also learned from my patients. So why? Well, I mean, the first thing we know is that human beings are social animals. We need social connection. And in fact, when we aren't getting the social connection that we find repleting and meaningful, we get sick. And the sickness we get is a feeling, a bad feeling of loneliness. And loneliness has been described as being analogous to hunger. When we're hungry, our body's telling us that we need food. When we feel lonely, our body is telling us we need more social connection that is meaningful, not just counting people, but meaningful. So
and that's an important distinction, and I think too often we overlook that notion that it has to be meaningful. I apologize for interrupting.
No. I'm sorry. So that I think that's so foundational to who we are and what we need as people. And then from there, the question is, how do we accomplish that? And I think it's very important to, I draw a lot on the work of John Cacioppo and his colleagues. Dr. Cacioppo has been described as the father of social neuroscience and the science of loneliness. And sadly, he passed away a few years ago, but his work said that there are at least three kinds of loneliness that we experience. And I mention these because the solutions are different for the three different kinds of loneliness. One is a sense of loneliness. Not everybody feels all of these, but a sense of loneliness due to not having an intimate connection with another person that's meaningful, that brings meaning, in which you feel valued, and it's a trusting relationship. The second type of loneliness is when has to do with the satisfaction of relationships with family or friends. And again, that's not a head count, that's a satisfaction count. And the third type of loneliness, which Dr. Cacioppo and his colleagues defined, is what they call public or collective loneliness. So a sense of loneliness because you don't feel like you have a place in a identity in your community, your neighborhood, your church, your synagogue, your mosque, or civil society, where you can make a contribution that is important and where you're valued, where you can wake up with a sense of meaning and purpose that goes beyond a relationship with one or another person. And they described very powerfully that this is also critically important to many people, that they feel like they're a valued member of their social framework, and civic framework or religious framework, whatever speaks to one. And this, as I said, the solutions are different for each of those. For the first two, it generally requires reaching out to another person to accomplish that, or having them reach out to you and then being able to reciprocate. On the third one, that's trickier. And I think any organization, senior living organizations, service organizations, civil organizations, and religious organizations have roles to play in creating the enabling conditions or organizations to bring people together around shared interests. Those interests could be having a walking club, it could be going bowling together, it could be a book club. I mean, people have many different interests, but having people that you can share interests with can be very meaningful to meet people who you can build a relationship with. The other is something else you said, which is whether you have a way to come together for shared meaning and purpose for the greater good. And that matters to people, no matter what age they are. In fact, there's a lot of reason to think it matters more and more as people get older, that they know they've made a difference in their world, and that they've made a difference that will live on beyond them.
Great point. Everybody wants to leave a legacy of some sort. And I think sometimes we set the bar so high. We see, you know, people that are truly changing the world, and it probably, you know, I mean, as I think about my legacy, what will that be, and what will be remembered, and you know, it's sometimes difficult to think about what that might be, but that is important.
Right, I learned that from my patients as well. Not infrequently saw someone who was really feeling ill and had been for quite a while. And ultimately, the cause was that I identified for many people, not everybody, many people, was that they had no reason to get up in the morning. And that's very painful, and it can make you sick.
Absolutely. And you know, it's interesting. I've led a number of focus groups and other discussions in senior living communities with residents, with family members, et cetera. And I've heard countless stories about how older adults have preferred to stay at home and preferred to live there, but blossomed once they got into a community setting. And, you know, it's not about any particular community, but just having that, you know, the relationships, the connections, the, I think people think when they're in their 70s, 80s, they can't make new friends, but, you know, it really, I mean, it just underscores all of the points you were making, at least from what I've observed, anecdotally, but it's fascinating. So as a leader in public health and a pioneer in aging research, you've been at the forefront of shaping how public health systems respond to our aging population. How has the field of public health evolved to better address the needs of an aging society?
So I think the field of public health science has contributed a lot. And I'll tell you a little bit about that. The challenge is that we're not yet using it. And I think that is the necessity of the 21st century, is to actually design a public health system that can deliver the conditions that use the evidence in every community for every person. So what am I talking about? So public health science has shown over the last 50 years, 40 years, 30 years, has shown us that something that was an argument when I was in training as a physician. The argument that I heard from my betters was, do you think prevention would work in older people? And if it did, do you think it would matter? Well, you're laughing, Derek. And that's the right reaction, because lo, a few decades later, we think that's a ridiculous question, because of course it does.
Right.
Right? But 30 years ago, it was an argument.
Interesting.
And so public health science has been the basis for us now being able to say that most chronic diseases are preventable if we do the right things to do it.
Sure.
That it is like that if you prevent these chronic diseases, you can delay or even prevent disability. We've learned that actually, for example, with frailty, frailty is not a disease. It's a aging-related process, which is sometimes kicked off by a few diseases, but sometimes happens when there are no diseases as people get older. But it's not a disease. And so there are other kinds of geriatric conditions like frailty that can be prevented or slowed. And health can be promoted. So you can actually invest in maintaining your resilience, your vitality. We have a lot more to learn, but we've learned enough to say we can get going. Half of all chronic diseases are preventable. That's a very big deal.
Yeah.
But what has happened, and we are not, we've used some of that, like we've made huge inroads in stroke prevention and heart disease prevention over the last 25 years. I think we've learned that, which has really diminished the risk of heart disease and stroke quite dramatically. But if prevention is the game, then we need an effector arm. We need a way to bring that out to communities. Some of it can be done in medical care. Some of it can be done through the health behaviors that we each adopt. But most of it has to be done through population-based approaches that put in place in every community, in every senior living facility, the conditions that make it possible for people to be healthy. I'll give you an example. One is in a senior living facility. Is there a place to exercise? Is there assistance to do it or machines to get stronger with? Another is, are there places in the community to walk and walk safely? Now, one individual can't create that, no matter how much they want to walk every day. If there is no place to walk safely, and I mean, is there a path where you won't trip and break your hip? And is it well lit? And does one feel confident that one's not going to be assaulted? Those are the conditions that make it possible for people to exercise outside that one person alone can't accomplish. Similarly, if you decide you need to eat a healthy diet, or your doctor or nurse tells you what a healthy diet should be, if you can't actually find a grocery store that sells healthy food, or if they do, if it's not affordable, you can't follow that healthy diet.
Sure.
So only we as a collective, as a community, as a country can create those conditions. If I tell you one of the strongest risk factors for heart disease, lung disease, and dementia is air pollution, and death, it's the fourth leading cause of death in the world, then if we allow air pollution to get worse after having conquered it over the last 30 years in this country, we will see a resurgence in those diseases and death.
Wow.
So again, this is not something that the individual can solve alone. These are the roles of us collectively and the roles of a public health system designed for health and longer lives to take on, to be empowered to take on, so that every people in every community have the opportunity for health.
Hmm. You know, I do think it was amazing, and I don't mean to speak lightly about it, but over the pandemic, obviously there were a lot of very tragic things happening, but it was interesting to see the effect of reducing the use of vehicles and other sorts of things, where in India you could see the blue sky, and in parts of the United States and Los Angeles, it cleared out, and the earth can heal itself, and which can lead to a healthier environment. So it was interesting to see how quickly that could change if there was real dramatic change.
Absolutely. So these are things. Going back to Dr. Cacioppo's idea of public or collective loneliness, if we don't see a way to affect those changes that could benefit each of us, but benefit all of us at no cost to one of us, then that's a kind of loneliness where you feel disempowered.
Yeah.
And conversely, if everybody got together and said, we have to do this, then you have a place in a community that matters.
Sure. And I think you touched on it to varying degrees, in this conversation, but what does a truly age-friendly public health system look like?
So we don't have it yet, and we don't have it yet in part because the evidence of what it could be is new, the last few decades. As I was talking about before, in part because this country, sadly, has been progressively disinvesting in its unique and treasured public health system for decades as well, because it's an easy target to disinvest in prevention, because you won't see the results for 6 months or a year. It's not like somebody walking into a hospital and being critically ill and you say, sorry, we don't provide care for that anymore. You can't. The impact is no less devastating.
That's
to not have
point.
Public health, but the recognition of its significance is highly delayed from the time when the disinvestment happens. So we now know enough to design a whole new public health system. And it's the right time. So I said we've added 30 years to human life expectancy in the last 100 years in the U.S. We're living a whole new additional stage of life. What I didn't say was that 25 of those 30 years came from the 20th century's public health system. Now the challenge is for us as a country to invest in a public health system that will similarly add 25 of the next 30 years of health during those years. Public health delivers 70% of a population's health, medical care 20%. you can't have health unless you have both sides of that health coin. So what would a health public health system look like? Well, it would be an investment from birth to death in a very high return on investment enterprise, which is to invest in preventing chronic diseases at every age and stage of life. People in the U.S. are getting sicker earlier with chronic diseases, diabetes, heart disease, stroke, hypertension, cancers, because the conditions of our lives have changed. And we need a public health system that can level set the opportunity for health for everybody. And it's a cumulative proposition of investing at every age for future health as well as present health. And then we need to add, and we could do this, and the return on investment, the economics of this, highly advantageous for the country. But then we would add what we've never really built, which is what older people need additionally. So how do we prevent not just stroke in older people, but how do we prevent loss of function if somebody gets a stroke? How do we, if somebody loses a spouse, how do we support them in our communities with a system that helps them handle the grief, build a new life? That's not all what only sit with the public health system, but the public health system has a role in then joining with other sectors to build what you were saying before, the ways to build social connection. Supposing somebody's homebound, how do we go into their home and deliver prevention so that they don't get worse? How do we build social connection even though they're homebound? How do we actually prevent people from getting sick because there aren't too many medications? There's a long list of things that we could do to help people stay healthy or diminish the risks of future ill health. And we need to build a public health system for the 21st century in every community that helps people age with health as well as longer years.
Sure, sure. So where are the biggest gaps right now in how we approach aging from a public health perspective?
So I think the biggest gaps are in just not delivering the conditions in communities that help people be healthy, the traditional role of public health. I'm concerned that there are going to be cutbacks in even how we track who's sick with what and how many people in different age groups have what kinds of problems so that we can plan the prevention and services that are needed, because they vary to some degree from community to community. So how do we target what a given community would benefit from? And then we need to build really the mandate for prevention for older people and build the capabilities in a newly trained public health workforce that understands how to do prevention across the whole life course and for older adults.
Sure, sure. Now, you've talked about how you have a global perspective. You've certainly interacted with folks from, you know, all the continents. Are there particular countries or public health systems around the world that you think are doing an especially good job of supporting healthy aging? And what can we learn from them?
So, very important question. I guess I have two answers. One is the U.S. has a precious thing unlike any other country in the world, which is a public health system. I think it needs to be modernized, and we have not put the resources into it to do that. But we have the basis for delivering health into every community, and now we need to design it for the world we are, which is one that is living long lives. No other country really has the kind of really innovative public health system that was designed in the mid-20th century in the U.S. However, there are countries that are, and attending very much to how to the necessity to figure out how to help people stay healthy longer. And I can cite Singapore because when the National Academy of Medicine's Global Roadmap for Healthy Longevity was published in 2022, the government of Singapore read it, leaders and the deputy prime minister read the report and said, we're implementing this cover to cover. And they are. And so they really are building a 21st century version of what public health should look like, what medical care should look like, how we need to redesign for social connection and cohesion and meaning and purpose that brings people together within and across generations, and how that all adds up to the fact that our longevity could be a basis for all ages thriving, not despite it.
Sure. Yeah, that's interesting. I have heard other folks talk about Singapore and how progressive they are in implementing some of these ideas and notions and such. So it's fascinating. I think you mentioned that your co-chair was from Singapore, correct?
Yes, he was.
Okay, good. So this is a question that I ask every guest. What are you looking forward to as you age, Linda?
I'm looking forward to a lot of things, actually. Number one, I have my first ever grandchild was born 9 months ago.
Oh, congratulations.
And so I'm just looking forward to us knowing each other deeply as she grows and being part of her life.
That's a great point. Now, is she there in New York with you?
No, they're in Washington, D.C.
Okay. So at least on the coast or in the same general region. But that's great. Congratulations.
Thank you. And I'm looking forward to investing and being with friends and family. And I'm looking forward to a chance to take a broad view and think broadly about what we need to accomplish to make it so that the long lives we're living are ones that are valued by the individual and by society, and in which everyone can thrive because there are more older people around. And I think there are probably many new and exciting perspectives that we could take on that, and I'm looking forward to learning.
Yeah, and I love that. You've obviously had a very distinguished career, but we can always learn, right?
Absolutely. It's what gets me up in the morning. It's so much fun.
That's well said. So you've been an advocate for creating environments that support healthy aging across all aspects of life, from healthcare to city planning. Now, in your view, what does an age-friendly community truly look and feel like?
I think it, there are a number of answers. It's a community that is built to value people of all ages. Built means for the same reason that older people might need a little more time to walk across the street a sidewalk that's not all broken up to get down the street. So do people with baby carriages. So we need to think about our design so that enables everybody to be able to be in their city. We need to design a world that fosters social connection. The social infrastructure of, I live in an apartment building, as do most people in New York, and I would say that a number of years ago, designs to bring people together disappeared. Very hard to find public space in many apartment buildings, including senior living. So we need to rethink how to create the opportunities for people to connect. And older people need it. But so do young people. Young people are also starving for social connection. And then we need to build bridges for intergenerational connection.
Absolutely.
We need to create the opportunity for older people to work for pay if they want to, and make that make their presence one that values the assets that older people bring and the capabilities, and actually designs new work roles that utilize them. Because most of our work roles, except maybe programming and some tech, were created when life expectancy was half of what it is now, and weren't designed to utilize the capabilities of people, all of us, as we get older. And then we need to really think about whether older people not only want, because they do, but should have opportunities for roles in which they can come together with others to improve their world. And we have not designed or invested in roles that matter, roles people would be proud to have, and roles that can actually be impactful to improve deeply hurting needs in probably every community.
I mean, those are really important points. Where do you think either the responsibility for creating those roles should lay, or where do you think the best chance for them to be successful would lay? Is it in the corporate environment? Is it in the public sector? Academia? Where do you see that happening?
Yeah, so it's a particularly important time to ask that question. I appreciate it a lot. I think there's a place for every sector to think about that. I'm sitting in academia, and I would say that we haven't figured out the roles for faculty and staff who have retired, and we need to. Some places have, but it's not generally done. There's some work in the corporate sector made popular by movies about mentorship by retired older people. But there are immense capabilities that older employees have that I think, if valued, would lead to new kinds of roles for older employees. It also requires redesigning for the kinds of roles that would keep older people in the workplace. The challenge we have is that I think that older people who come with, not everybody, but interestingly, for most of us, as we get older, we develop new kinds of capabilities we never had when we were 20, 30, 40. We have advanced capabilities in problem solving, having been doing it for decades. We have clear ideas of what matters and what doesn't matter. As older people become more generous to others. And older people actually have more emotional balance, and with all of those capabilities, are better able to solve conflict. And older people want to make a difference, as you said, want to leave a legacy of goodness. But there are not roles at scale for that. But think about those assets. If there was investment in creating roles in older people in every community at scale, so that every older adult who wanted to do something had a role that mattered to them, think of the transformation we would have. All those assets and the time to do it. That's very powerful. That, however, there you're talking unified appreciation of how much this could unleash thriving of communities to allow older people through roles that could be impactful to make a difference. And then you're talking about a critical role for government to set the vision, to lead other sectors to join in, to provide the sustaining investment, to demand that the roles matter and have impact, and aren't just window dressing. So I think it's an all-sector proposition. This doesn't seem to be a time when we deeply believe in public goods, the things we invest in together that no one of us can create alone, and that raise all boats. But that's what we're talking about.
And hopefully we'll get back to that. But, you know, it is interesting hearing you talk about meaningful pay for work and providing those opportunities to have impact. You know, I talk to a lot of folks who are really looking forward to retirement, and other people who are a little trepidatious, and folks who have retired and are lost. And it's really a shame when people have felt that sense of contribution over their careers, whatever it may have been, and suddenly find themselves kind of, you know, in the wilderness, so to speak.
Yeah. So I learned that also from my patients, and I'll tell you one story. I had the first patient who taught me that was a gentleman who was in his late 60s, who had just retired a couple months before from being the CEO of a large corporation. And he came in ill. And after talking to him a good amount, there was really nothing going on for him, except that he had gone from being on top of the world as the CEO to being invisible in the world 2 months later as an old man, or perceived as an old man. Nobody saw him on the street. He just walked through invisible. And he had no reason to get up in the morning, and it was killing him. So I did something I'd never done before, because it was very clear he didn't need any medicine. There was no medicine that could treat what was hurting. And so I wrote a prescription for him, because I was used to writing physical activity prescriptions. I said, go and find an organization that matters to you and volunteer, and then come back and tell me how it went. So he came back about a month and a half later, and he said, Dr. Fried, I went and volunteered at this organization he cared a lot about, and they put me in a corner licking stamps to put them on envelopes. Nobody asked me what I knew how to do.
Interesting.
They just saw this old man. He was only 68, but this old man, and they assigned a task that needed to be done. And I said, you know, I'm old enough to know that life is short and that what I have to contribute isn't in that role. And he said, so I quit. So I've heard that story so many times. We need to build roles that value the assets people have, that enable them, that harness them in ways that they want to contribute. And then, because most of the problems in our world, no one of us can solve, enable bringing together a bunch of us on some scale to make the difference that's needed together.
Sure, sure. You know, I think one of the I'm sure it's somewhat inconsistent in how it's implemented, but are you familiar with SCORE? I'm trying to think what it stands for, but it's retired executives who provide free consulting for startup businesses and others along the way. And
that's wonderful.
It seems like such a wonderful way. Now, it's not paid, but nonetheless, it allows them to mentor and share their knowledge and their skills, and also providing some of that intergenerational communication. So that's been I learned about that when I was getting my MBA, that we had some interactions with our local SCORE chapter in the town where I was going. But it was just fascinating to learn about that as a concept. And then now, as I'm working with this population, it is just an amazing role. So I have another question I'd like to ask. Aging in place is a goal for many older adults who want to remain in their homes, in the communities that they've lived in as they grow older. What policies or initiatives have you seen that successfully promote aging in place?
So there are a number. One is that people need some services as they age, if they are ill, if they're homebound, if they just really can't manage certain tasks. And there needs to be a way to deliver them. I very much like the CAPABLE program as one example, which was developed by Dr. Sarah Santon. And that provides a combination of services of an occupational therapist to come into the home and think about how to organize, for example, your kitchen so that you know, if you have trouble standing and cooking or reaching things, so that you can actually do what you want to do. And it helps you set things up so it works. That's very personal. CAPABLE also has a handyman who can come in and help do small repairs. So if you suddenly are wheelchair bound and somebody needs to push you out of your home, but you have stairs there, you need somebody who can build a ramp. And there are lots of such examples inside of just helping your home stay in a state of good repair. So those are two examples. Living in New York where you can get almost anything delivered, I have to say, is an immense help. You know, so maybe you can get to the store, but you can't carry the groceries back. Or maybe you just need to go online and order the groceries or call the store. But having businesses that will deliver what you need is immensely helpful.
Sure. Sure.
Having the ability to have visits by clinicians, by nurses, by occupational or physical therapy in your home. So not only so you don't have to go out to get to an appointment if that's difficult, but also so they can see the environment you're living in and think about how to make it more fitting. And then there's the need for connection. Sometimes connection is public transport of different kinds. If you have a walker or you're in a wheelchair, having a bus that can put down a ramp so that you can get on the bus makes all the difference in the world to whether you can go see your friends. Having an accessor ride be available. The other connection, which we saw we really desperately need during the pandemic, is internet connectivity, which I think should be a public utility that everybody has access to. And older people certainly need it.
I was just going to ask, what role can technology play in a lot of these things and in connections? And you've kind of just gone there with the internet. Are there other technological advancements that you've seen in your practice, in your studies that are really important?
Yeah, I think telehealth is really important. You know, you want to have a personal relationship with your doctor or your nurse, but and seeing them in person is important to setting up that personal relationship. But once that's established, if you can have telehealth visits so you don't have to travel to them, I think that's a huge advance. That's a key example. But there are other kinds of connectivity. So being built that we need more of, connectivity of social groups online, connectivity of services like clubs or groups to help people who have been bereaved. There are a lot of kinds of groups like that I think are increasingly able to come together online. The key thing is to provide the training so older people who are not proficient with using computers and being on the internet have developed the skills to do that. And there's a lot of very important training that can provide that.
Sure, sure. So how do we ensure that these age-friendly efforts are also equitable across race, income, geography?
Mm-hmm. So that's one of the reasons that I think a public health system is critical. Public health system with a health department in every community that understands the challenges to health for that community can help bring together the different sectors to solving those, innovating together, protecting people's health, responding to different needs. Sometimes they should be the needs should be addressed by one group which has more expertise or another group. But you need a coordinating function in a community that really can deliver what that community needs. The other is how we invest and value that we need to make investments in every community. And investing in your community and you actually ultimately makes everybody better in other communities as well. So there's a mindset, I think, of wanting every community to thrive and not seeing investment in one as a threat to another, because the evidence suggests that that is not the reality of what happens.
I love that idea. Hopefully we can implement that more widely. But now, as people live longer, healthier lives, the traditional life stages, education, work, retirement, they no longer fit as neatly as they once did. With increasing life expectancy, how do we need to rethink the structure of life from work to education to retirement?
It's so important. You know, I remember as a young parent being completely constantly stressed out trying to manage having young kids, a husband who I loved but didn't get to see enough, work that was very demanding, and it felt often like you couldn't keep up with everything. So how to not just think about this for the whole life course, but attend to how to lift some of the weight over different points in life course, I think is really important. Laura Carstensen and the Stanford Center on Aging has done a lovely job of bringing many of us together across the country to try and answer your question. And I think it's become clear to a lot of us that we need to think differently about we have the privilege and opportunity of thinking differently about our life course. 100 years ago, you could expect, if you were white, to live 47 years on average. And many people live less long than that. Now we can expect at birth to live 80 to 90 years on average. And planning for that means that we don't have to squeeze everything into the first 47 years.
Right.
We can think about how we really would thrive if we could rearrange it. We're going to be working have 4 to 5 careers over our long lives. We're going to need education that doesn't end when we're 18 or 20 or 25, but actually education that we can go back to prepare for the next career at different points in our lifetime. I'm very aware that my grown kids have a new baby where I want to help out, and helping out can help them and can uplift that. So maybe we need new ways for older people to be able to take a break from work so they can help their kids.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, almost the whole maternity, paternity, leave, but for older adults, mm-hmm. as grandparents.
Interesting. And, you know, maybe we need the opportunity when we retire, should we retire, to do a year of national service and explore, do something we've never done before, but make a difference in doing it and contribute great value to our communities or our nation. Maybe many young people I've heard from lots of parents aren't quite ready to go to college when they're done with high school. Maybe we need a different kind of break where they can grow up a little for a few years, participate in national service, and then go on for more education when they're ready to really value it. Sure. So I think there are lots of ways we could mix this up where each age group could have a better opportunity to thrive.
Sure. Sure. Now, you've written about the idea of a third age, a period of purpose and contribution later in life. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I'm happy to. So I've been, over the years, since the learning from the patients I mentioned, it's been very clear to me from research that I've done and from a gazillion conversations that many people retire with a goal of making a difference in the way they never had time to do when they were working. They want to make contributions to their community or their country or the world. And in fact, we have this gift of an extra 30 years of life that we never had. And increasingly, we're seeing that it's possible to live those 30 years with more health, with a lot of health. And when people have adequate health, they do want to have a role with meaning and purpose in it. So when I talk about this third stage of life, we haven't built it yet. I've spent a good amount of time the last few decades building one model, but we need many models of roles that people would really value where they could feel like they achieved the legacy they needed to leave. Sometimes that's their family, but many times in addition to what they contribute to their family, people want to make a difference. They want to know that the kids in their neighborhood are succeeding in school. They want to feel like they had a part in that. They want to know that we're protecting people against the health threats of climate change, and they were part of that. They want to know that we're actually building healthy environments in our communities, and they were part of achieving that, or, you know, mentoring young people to be able to enter the workforce. The list goes on and on,
sure,
of
sure.
Unmet needs, and people want roles that matter. They're not necessarily, and often not full-time roles, but they want to be able to contribute in a way that has significance. So I think we have not everybody can do it. Not everybody wants to do that. Maybe this year I want to, and next year I won't want to, or I can't. But we need to have the roles ready for a fifth of our population who is over 65 and a quarter who's over 60.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Now, looking back on your career, what moments or accomplishments stand out the most to you?
Oh, that's a hard question to think of an answer for. I suppose, I've had the privilege of being able to think about things that seemed important to me and to follow the trail long enough that I could see solutions that weren't known and define problems that hadn't been defined. And that's a privilege to be able to do that. And I do it because I think it will matter to people and improve lives. And
that's
so
great.
There are a few things that I particularly treasure that I had the time and ability and I guess opportunity to figure out. Certainly figuring out what frailty was about is one of them. I've spent a lot of years building a model called Experience Corps, which offers one kind of role for older people to make a difference, in this case, for children to succeed in public elementary schools, which is critical to our country's future and those kids' future. But I think maybe figuring out as sort of rolling up all these different things about how we could keep people healthy, how we could bring meaning and purpose and diminish loneliness, I think is the realization that we could create a stage of life in which everybody of all ages could thrive because that stage of life existed and was designed to meet goals and keep people healthy. and we could create, I could go full geek on you here. I realized we could create something I've called a third demographic dividend because of longevity. So what we
what does
know,
that mean?
Well, that's why this is really geeky. But economists and demographers have said that human societies have gone through two major transitions in every country of the world, including the U.S. A first demographic dividend, when children started surviving childhood, and because of that, families starting realized they didn't have to have as many kids. And that was a product of primarily public health investments and more education as societies go from an agrarian to an industrial society. And then as you make investments in health and more education, kids start actually surviving to adulthood. And if they have the education that enables them to get jobs, as happened in the U.S. after World War II, then you have an immensely productive workforce and economy that powers the country to become wealthy and thrive and gives the country enough money to invest more in more health and more education. And you have this virtuous cycle going on. That's as far as we've figured it out. And what I have realized is that if we go to the next stage of what you've been talking about, Derek, and we design a society for the longer lives we've created in which people can be healthy in older age, in which they can have roles that bring meaning and purpose, in which they can contribute through work or volunteering or caregiving or other things, that we will see a third demographic dividend that we never imagined before, and which all ages thrive because we have longevity. And that to me is really exciting.
That's really cool. That's, I never really thought about it that way, but you know, I appreciate the story and, you know, geeking out a little bit with us. So what's been the most difficult challenge that you've experienced in advocating for older adults in public health? There are probably several, but what's one of the most difficult, would you say?
I think the very difficult challenge is that because we are so afraid of getting old and of dying in this country, in our culture, that we devalue the people who are old. And if we devalue them, if they think that they're only dependent, they're only disease-ridden, they're only demented, the list goes on and on. There are a lot of D's there. And it's not, then we're frightened of that, and we don't recognize the huge assets that human beings need to thrive that come from all of us as we get older, or could. And but without that understanding and that narrative, we as a society, certainly in my career, consistently resist investing in older people or in the conditions in which we can all thrive and older people can thrive because of those investments. And we see them as either or propositions. We have a mythology, which I won't attribute to anybody, that if we invest in old people, we're taking food and resources out of the mouths of children. The truth is that is not true. The truth is everybody gains. The truth is that if older people are working, we create an economy that thrives and it creates more jobs for young people so they can work. And the story goes on and on. But we have to fix the thing that has driven me the most crazy is that we block our opportunity to collectively thrive through this narrative. We block our opportunity to build healthcare for older people. We have not invested in geriatric medicine or nursing, and that is the branch of medicine which could do the most
sure
for older people's health.
Interesting.
On the medical side. And we have absolutely resisted building public health for healthy longevity. And we would all flourish if we had both of those.
Sure. So what gives you hope about the future of aging and longevity?
Actually, the science gives me hope. Because the sciences of what we've learned changes the ability, amplifies, creates the ability to create a narrative that's real about what it means to get older and why that could benefit everybody. And the story is very robust now. It's not complete, but it's very robust. I also think, actually, that the loneliness of young people, which matches the loneliness of old people, is an opportunity we have to meet. And young people are lonely for some of the same reasons that older people are lonely and for some different ones. But each generation needs the other generation in their life.
Absolutely. And I've certainly seen the positive impacts when that happens.
So. Yeah. Yeah, it's wonderful.
So you've been very generous with your time. I have one last question. What have you learned that you wish you could have told your younger self?
Laugh more.
I love that. That's great. I think that's a perfect way to wrap things up. Dr. Fried, Linda, you've been very generous with your time. Really appreciate the insights, the wisdom, and frankly, the impacts you're having on society, which a lot of us probably aren't even aware of, but thank you for that. And thank you for your time today.
Thank you for the honor of joining you.
That's Take great. Good care. Thank Bye-bye. You. And I'd also like to thank our engineer, Matt Campbell, and our producer, Dave Schaffner. And I look forward to talking with you on the next episode of Roundtable Talk.